Welcome to Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the rare disease community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the 2025 American Society of Human Genetics Conference in Boston, and our guest is Dr. Matthew Mite, the director of the Hugh Call Precision Medicine Institute at the University of Alabama. He's also the father of Bertrand, who had NGLY1 deficiency, a rare metabolic disorder, and he passed away 5 years ago at the age of 12. Thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, your story is that of a professional from a very personal point of view as a dad. Tell us your story, if you would.
Sure. So for me, it's, you know, the personal has become professional over time. For me, it really started when Bertrand was 6 months old. That was the point when we knew something was wrong. Not what was wrong, but we knew something was wrong. And it was actually my first day on the job as a professor in computer science at the University of Utah. And so it was the beginning of a diagnostic odyssey. That diagnostic odyssey lasted 4 years. And it really took the invention of exome sequencing to finally resolve it. So he was in one of the earliest cohorts of exome sequencing to try to figure out, you know, the root cause of likely genetic diseases. And in his case, it was actually figured out. So Duke University ran that study. And not only did they find an answer, but they also told us something pretty surprising, which was that he was the first case ever discovered of his particular disorder, which happened to be NGLY1 or NGLY1 deficiency. So suddenly, what had been a diagnostic odyssey became two more odysseys, one to find a community and the other to find a treatment. And really what happened to me is my life became ever more consumed by this passion. And I used social media to find more patients. And remarkably, we actually found patients within just 2 weeks. I wrote a blog post that was designed to go viral and highlight the key symptoms of the disorder, which were things like, development delay, epilepsy, but curiously also a lack of tears. And that tended to be what brought people to us.
Can you give us a description of what exactly is NGLY1 deficiency?
Sure. So in the case of NGLY1 deficiency, it's really a total loss of this particular gene. The gene itself is actually responsible for deglycosylating misfolded glycoproteins, or that was really what we assume was its sole function for a long time. The recent Nobel Prize winner, Gary Revkin, actually published a paper several years ago showing it has a second function. And he wasn't trying to do research on the disorder. It was just some other research he was doing, and he tripped across this gene. Turns out it is essential for deglycosylating some ordinary or functional proteins like NRF1. And so that actually opened some therapeutic avenues for the disorder. In fact, by the time that his paper had come out, I was already in the middle of a new career. By then, I was already the director of the Precision Medicine Institute at UAB. And by then, I already had my hands on an AI platform that we had built that allowed us to sift through the literature, integrate new literature, and identify potential therapies. And so when we pushed this information into the system, out popped a recommendation for something called sulforaphane, because it would upregulate a compensatory pathway in this particular case. And that's just one example of the kinds of things I was able to do for Bertrand therapeutically over the course of his life.
The talk that you're giving here at this conference is titled, How AI is Transforming Genome-Guided Medicine, a Personal and Professional Perspective. Let's step back, if we could, because a lot of our listeners may not understand some of these terms, myself included. We all know what AI is, but in the context of this conference and particularly with genetics, how does AI transform genome-guided medicine?
So AI really transforms it several ways, and maybe we should define AI briefly. So I think the simplest definition I give is that it's an AI that mimics human behavior in some way. You might also say it's a machine that in some way requires human intelligence to accomplish a particular task. And I think what's really changing it right now is generative AI. My shorthand version for that is that it's a machine that mimics human creativity, including creative reasoning. And that's relevant because, it opens up a lot within the context of genomic medicine. It works on the precision diagnostic side when we're trying to figure out whether particular mutations are actually driving a disease. On the therapeutic side, it actually helps us combine lots of different information together to figure out if there might be an existing drug that can be repurposed for a particular disorder, which is what I do a lot of now.
So when you started this journey, of course, you said your son was the only one with the disease that you knew of. Today, how many people or cases have you been able to come up with?
So there's over 100 known cases now that are all stitched together through this really family group that's formed online.
Worldwide or just in the U.S.?
Worldwide, yeah.
So where are some of the other cases?
So the first other cases I ever found, there was a sibling pair in Turkey. Then the next two patients were siblings in Israel. And then after that, finally met another patient in the U.S. that was in California. So they're really all over the world.
What's the median survival?
You know, it depends, but I would say kids tend to pass away sometime in their mid to late teens, although some have lived significantly longer than that. So that might be the median, but you know, we don't know just how long some of them can live if they have the less severe forms of it.
What are the symptoms and how did you realize and when, at what point that something was wrong?
So for Bertrand, the symptoms, and for most of the kids, the symptoms are severe developmental delay, epilepsy, an unusual movement disorder, and then an inability to cry tears. Those are the big ones that come up over and over.
And that inability to cry tears is kind of unusual.
It's very unusual. And that's what makes it easy to recognize sometimes from the outside when parents go, oh yeah, my kid doesn't cry tears. That's often the light bulb moment. Yeah, they don't make tears. And day to day, it's a big problem because they get recurrent eye infections and it's messy to deal with a lack of tears on a day to day basis. In some ways, it's more challenging to deal with the lack of tears than the epilepsy.
Really? And so when you talk about epileptic seizures, how frequently were they?
It depended. Without good treatment, they were, in some cases, over 100 per day. But over the course of his life, got essentially total control over the seizures and was often having none per day, even shortly before he passed away.
That unusual number of seizures sounded like it could be Dravet syndrome.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the differentials early on, was Dravet. And I think Rett syndrome was another early differential. So it can look similar to some other disorders that are out there. In fact, when you talk to the NGLI1 patient community, they're often sort of frequently early on misdiagnosed with the same things right, until they do the genetic follow-up and realize that's not it.
Is there a patient advocacy group for people with the disease?
There is. There's a strong NGLI1 community. We're sort of integrated within the broader CDG community. So this is the broader community for glycosylation disorders. So CDG Care serves as an umbrella advocacy organization for the larger class of disorders. And then there's a foundation run by one of the parents, the Gray Science Foundation, which has been very active. They actually have recently launched a gene therapy for the disorder. So it's in clinical trials now.
So I wanted to ask you, at this conference, which is, the largest genetics conference in the world, from what I understand, how familiar are participants with this specific deficiency?
So I think maybe a little more than they should be, because I've been somewhat vocal in the past and sort of pushed myself into the academic community when it comes to genetics. So even though it's a relatively small disorder, it might have some outsized mind share here.
I see. What in your talk do you think would be relevant to this general audience? What can be applied to across the board to all genetic diseases?
So I think the high level message is that AI has strong potential on the diagnostic side. So if you're looking for a diagnosis, and has strong potential on the therapeutic side. So if you're looking for ways to creatively reuse the existing arsenal of approved drugs in ways that make molecular sense for a given genetic disorder, we have whole new techniques that we didn't have even 5 years ago.
Not necessarily new drugs. These are existing drugs that are being used, repurposed for something else.
Yeah. So again, a lot of what I do now, I really focus on repurposing because it's the easiest, least expensive thing to do for the vast majority of rare genetic diseases. I'm not saying we can always find something, but it's relatively inexpensive to look. And so I think that's usually where we start. I also co-direct the Center for Precision Animal Modeling at UAB. And so for disorders that require significantly more scientific bench work, we can do some of that too.
Animal modeling, meaning basically mouse models?
We do mouse models, but we actually prefer the smaller organisms when we can get away with it. So if we can get away with a zebrafish or a C. elegans, we'd much rather model on a more scalable organism, because one of the things we like to do in those cases is, where it's tractable, actually test lots of drugs on these genomically engineered models and see if anything works.
I see. We're almost out of time. Any final thoughts?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's a different era for parents and for patients in rare disease. And I would say, just if you're going to use AI, make sure you're consulting a professional at the same time. And I do mean like a medical professional, so that if you're getting advice out of these systems, and there's a lot of off-the-shelf ones, make sure you're grounding that advice with a clinician.
Okay. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Dr. Matt Mite, director of the Hugh Call Precision Medicine Institute at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Thank you very much. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.